Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. My guest today is, in my humble opinion, one of the sharpest and most thoughtful political journalists out there. Ested Herndon's New York Times podcast, The Run-Up, did an amazing job this last cycle, pulling back the cover on how national politics is done, and especially showing that gulf that exists between the parties and the insiders and actual voters. Ested has set himself apart from the pack through this kind of political journalism. He picks apart conventional wisdom and elevates the complexities and gray areas that are critical in understanding this political moment. He's also been skeptical of the idea that traditional forms of political journalism can keep up with the significant changes we've seen in the way Americans receive and process that fire hose of digital media coming at them every single day. One reason why he made the decision to leave the New York Times for a role at Vox, where he'll take on the role of host and editorial director and create a new weekly video podcast about, of course, politics starting next year. This was a really interesting conversation. We covered everything from the midterms to the World Cup and everything in between. We recorded it on Wednesday, November 19th. Ested Herndon, I'm so happy to have you on the pod. This is fantastic.
I'm so happy to be here. I love chatting with you.
Thank you. And I love chatting with you.
I'm putting on my glasses because you make me want to be smarter.
Yeah, you do. You look already, and they're kind of cat eye. So it gives you that very Ested thing, which is I'm smart, but also I'm unpredictable. You can't put me in a box. Let's talk about, first of all, the congratulations on your new job over at Vox. You moved from the New York Times. And I watched your Instagram. I guess it's a reel or it's a story. I don't know. I still can't distinguish those things on social media. But you explained your new job allows you to bring your journalism across different mediums and also to be a little less formal. So what I wanted to ask you just to start this off is when we think about traditional journalism, is part of the reason it's struggling because it's too tied to the formal rules and a certain way of doing things? Or is it that there is just something else going on that makes it harder for traditional journalism to move in the way it did 10, 15, 20 years ago?
I mean, I don't want to make it all about user error. I think traditional journalism's up against a lot. Like, I think that the information ecosystem has totally changed. You know, I read Adam Negurny's book about the history of the Times a couple years ago, and people were like, what are you doing? I actually was really interested. Like, it really reminded me about how recently, like, news figuring out the internet was, you know? And just how even the digital success of the place is new, you know? And it was like about this struggle about how to find that right balance. And it actually really made me appreciate kind of more what news is up against. And I think that's obviously pre-AI, that is pre-subscription models, that's pre all this advertising changes. So I like want to say that first. But I do think there is a level of tied to traditional structures that has not served political journalism. I think that one of the takeaways I remember from 2016 when I was 22-3 and I was at the Boston Globe and I was like a local reporter was feeling the day after, you know, like political journalism has just not prepared me, not just for the result, but for the changes in the country. Like, why didn't I know the Bernie sentiment? Why didn't I know the Trump one? Like, what is the disconnect here where these big shifts have happened? And as a reader of news, I haven't known them, you know? And so that really informed how I saw post-2016 was like these traditional rules have not even produced their expected result or are not predictive. So not to mean they have to be blown up, but they definitely have to be supplemented with other types of reporting.
Yeah, give me an example of sort of traditional rules, because when I think of, you know, again, you work for the Boston Globe, you work for the New York Times, there are certain ways in which a story is put together and edited, right? Is that what you mean? Or is it the way in which you even approach the concepts?
I mean it in a couple ways. One, I think it just like the inverted pyramid of reading information is less and less people right now. So like 4 years ago, that led me to doing a podcast. You're now right. This leads me to recognizing we're all going to be on YouTube. So might as well try to be there in a way that feels most kind of self-personality forward. But even separate from that, you know, I think about how much reporter time is spent trying to know the VP pick in the last two cycles.
You know? I'm so glad you brought that up. I hate it. No one cares.
Also, no one cares. And they don't even leak. They just know they've texted two cycles. They've just texted their own supporters who it was. And I think about how much energy is spent there. Or little stuff about, for us who do field things, which is even rare in itself, how much energy is spent at a campaign rally only. So I was trying to sell our team over the last couple of years, if this is going to be about people who are traditionally not into politics or dislike both candidates, we're not going to find them at a rally. So at a minimum, we got to try to be more creative. And so I use those as two examples of just like places where I think our energy is misplaced. And I just think it shrinks the amount of people we're speaking to. And so like if you're not going to play in the buckets where most people are caring about, I think you then lock yourself into an audience that is only that kind of traditional news reader. And I just think those people are getting smaller and smaller.
Right. Although do you believe there's still a place for the written form?
For sure. I mean, like, I just did the Zoran piece. I just did.
Yep, of course.
You know, people were just talking. I was talking to people about, like, you know, every time I move around mediums, I get frustrated about the thing I miss, right? So I think that there is a way that the run-up can give you an emotional feeling about election or a sense of mood about the country that any individual piece was not going to do the same thing at.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a precise nature of writing and the permanence to writing that is super impactful. Like, for all of the podcasts I made, people talk to me about Zoran and the Kamala piece all the time, you know?
Right.
And those live, you know? And so I definitely know, I don't want to say it as if I think it has no place.
Right.
I guess really I'm thinking about election and I'm saying, I think in that context, that is when I prioritize most people possible.
Yep.
And so that leads me to video, that leads me to Vox.
Right. You know, as the mom to a 19-year-old, I appreciate more than ever. I don't know that he's ever read the news, right? It comes to him in YouTube. That's where it comes to.
I tell people, like, this is so clear in my life. If anyone in their 20s or anyone sub 30 knows me, it is not because they have listened to a Times podcast or watched CNN. It's because they've heard me talk about it on Hassan Piker, or they've heard me talk about it on some other streaming platform or some podcast that's reached them in a video format. And so I'm like, even in my own life, I've seen that turnover happen. But, you know, I have like an institutionalist bone, you know, like I couldn't go be a Substacker. I don't want to work for myself. Like, I want an editor. Like, I still think come election night, it's nice to be on CNN, you know, like, and so I'm like, there are some things that I couldn't fully get away with. Like, you know, I was telling people I had to spend the whole summer kind of talking my parents into what I was doing. And because they're like, you're doing what? Why? You know?
You had a good job.
Like,
you had a nice job. Why are you leaving it?
Right. Like, have you considered not. But I think that the part that they really understood, I remember telling them, I don't think the next election, even in a way that's different than 2019, works from the premise of times they won. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that narrative setting power has changed. Mm-hmm. And so if I want to be in a space that's leading the idea discussion, that's even where people really are, that's different now. And so I think that's partially me responding to what's been media changes in my whole life since I've been a journalist.
Yeah. Speaking of going back, I wanted to go back to an earlier point you said about the 2016 and realizing, gosh, what do we miss? And that's also what I wanted to ask you about is it is a trap that many journalists fall into. I will raise my hand, say I fall into it all the time, is the fighting the last war. Right? Mm-hmm, when we talk about the upcoming campaign, we lean too much back on what happened last time, right? Yeah. Everybody in 2017 went to diners to talk to white dudes with Trump caps. Yep. They missed a whole lot of what 2018 was about.
Whole much move,
We now are spending a lot of time talking about young men, especially young men of color, and Latino voters. What are we missing when we, not that they aren't important, but that is this election really going to be about that, or is this going to be about a group of people or an issues that we're not getting at because we're so focused on that last election?
No, I think it's a great question because I think about this all the time, you know, and I think we have to think about it in different parts, right? Like and I think this particularly is true, I think, in these post-presidential years where we get that trove of information, but it's not as if when we're talking about a presidential voter, we're talking about the same thing as obviously a midterm voter or a primary voter or those type of things. And so we have to separate those things out. And I think we can't act as if this information is fixed, right? We saw, I think in general, the nuance of a group, so speaking of Latino voters, the nuance is such that I think each time we take the data to say they're in firm column one or the other, it's a mistake, you know? And so you'll miss the shifts happening in New Jersey because you've defined Latinos by a small group of people who have no shared ethnic connection, you know? And so I think that's where I think we have to supplement our reliance. I think we have to supplement these data points amongst each other. And I think we also have to do real live reporting because people are responding to things in real time. I remember 2021, too, when we were starting to run up, particularly in 2022, and we checked in with voters that we had talked to leading into Biden winning, I remember how much had changed already, how the inflation crisis, how the immigration border, like southern border crisis, how there was already a sense that the party had gone all in on culture and identity issues and it wasn't tangible. And I was really thinking, whoa, like this is a sign of like you haven't checked in with these people enough. And so I think like in the right now of it all, so much has been focused on, I think, these ideological defining traits, and you miss the dynamic changes that are happening. I'm like, I met so many people in that Mamdani process who were Trump Zoran voters, right? And who might go back to Republicans, who might switch it. I mean, like, so I'm like, it's not as if they're thinking about it as some change in their political identity. And so that's why I think so many people who talk about politics have such a clear ideology themselves, that they're forcing people to live in these buckets that they don't exist in.
Yeah, and that leads to my next question is, then how should we be thinking about our politics now? Because you're right. Growing up, learning about politics, and then covering it in the early days, it was really clear there was a spectrum, and you fit on the conservative or the liberal end based on how you responded to certain set issues.
Litmus test these issues.
Litmus test issues, very much. Big government, less government.
Right.
Higher taxes, lower taxes. Now, it's all kind of mixed up, right? Is Donald Trump a conservative?
I mean,
I guess so on some things. Is Bernie Sanders, what does it mean to be a liberal Bernie Sanders candidate versus being a moderate, right? It feels like we have to redefine that completely.
I agree.
And how are you thinking about that as you're trying to, is the goal to redefine it or to say we just got to break our mindset about there being a hard and fast spectrum?
Well, one thing I have tried, even when, before we think about moving beyond it, yeah. I've tried to hold myself to being more specific even about ideologies. Yeah. Like, I think in our work, we should be making distinctions between leftist and liberal. I think we should be making distinctions between, I think moderate is means less and less these days. Or even when we talk about what progressive would have meant, I think there are, you know, I'm like, is Jasmine Crockett progressive? To me, I'm like, that's a good example of someone who I think in our modern politics, I don't think fits in those phrases. To me, I'm like, that someone's definitely a liberal. Like, yeah. But, or in this progressive, uses progressive language on certain issues. And right. I think sometimes we'll use progressive to mean like, do they talk about race and identity? Or exactly. Do they talk about like this and that? And I'm like, well, I bet you, like, you know, even people do this with Zora. He does a lot of class-focused language. But I have watched him talk about the power of immigrants and identity and the shared nature. And, like, that was meaningful to people. And so I think we've taken, I just don't think it's, I just think it's messy, to your point. But I would say even, how am I dealing with it to actually answer your question?
Yeah.
Is I'm trying to, I'm thinking about buckets beyond left, right, center. So I'm like, if I'm going to think about young people in general for the next 2 years, that's not something that has to be ideology forward. And I think that the changes among them will reflect in politics. But it's not as if I think I have to house it in specific electoral framework or in DNR, you know?
Right.
And so, right. or what's a group I think is undercover? People of faith. I'm like, if I'm thinking about faith, like, then I think I can see a left-right-center spectrum more clearly. I see that across demographics, and I can see how that affects people in different ways. But I'm like, I actually think some of those efforts might be more valuable. And so, particularly when I think about next year, one lesson I took from the run-up is, like, I talked about the midterms and, like, strict electoral politics too early.
Yeah, in what way? Of, like, how many seats and what does the map look like? Okay.
Yeah, I think that actually my goal now would be to deliver that information inside of a framework that I think more people latch on to.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second you start talking about midterm seats, too many people's brains turn off.
100%.
And I think I already know I want to deliver that information. I can capture that person, or that's going to be a part of what I do for sure. And so I just think, like, what we were doing in run-up was such a record creation that I think that kind of language was helpful. If I want to hit the most people possible, I actually think I have to think a little differently. And so partly to your point about being beyond ideology, I think is important. I actually think being beyond electoral politics is important too. And I think electoral politics then becomes a vessel for these ways we're thinking about changing country broadly rather than the strict. At least that's how I think I'm going to try to go about it.
I like the way that you're thinking about this because, look, what attracted me to covering politics is the fact that people are complicated. Voters are complicated. Politicians are complicated.
Yeah.
And what we're asking human beings to do is something that human beings are not very good at, which is taking a lot of complex information, a lot of sometimes information that negates your own preset opinions. And you got to sort it all out in your head, and you have a binary choice.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got to weigh all that. It's, you know, cognitive dissonance plays a very big role. So, but, and at the same time, so theoretically, that could lead to really interesting outcomes, like you're saying, the Trump Mamdani voter.
Yeah.
But it feels like what people are doing now is taking all that complex information and all the contradictory information and saying, well, I just got to go with somebody that is not Trump, or I got to go with somebody that is like Trump, right?
Yeah.
And so it's like,
they don't want to live in the complex.
That's right.
I hear what you're saying. I do think there is a sense of clarity that even that Trump and Mamdani both bring to their politics. And even for what I'm saying about reaching most people possible and having, I think Trump and Mamdani are two good examples of people who are engaged in an effort at mass politics.
Yeah.
And I think it's not, you know, I tell people that when I was at a Zoran rally and he says, you know, freeze the rent and this call and response, yep. you know, make buses fast and free. I'm like, the only other time I've seen that executed is build the wall.
Yep.
Like, I'm like, what is the call and response for Joe Biden? Like, what is the, you know, like, I'm not, right. that's not, yep. that doesn't exist. And so yep. I'm like, I do think, or even, you know, I tried to say this on election night, you know, when CNN was having a little meltdown because they're like, his tone wasn't as conciliatory and whatever, whatever. And I was like, you all, he is thinking about his base because he does not believe that he is going to accomplish these goals through traditional politics. He doesn't believe that he's going to just ask Albany nicely and they're going to give him the thing. He knows he has to, this army of people has to continue. And that's who that speech is for. And so I'm like, that's a different way of going about politics. That's
right.
I mean, if you're going to do inside-out strategy, it requires uncomfort on the outside, right?
Right.
And
right.
so I think Trump does that. I think Zoran does that. And I think, to your point, there is a clarity to that, you know? And I think that's easy for people to latch on to. But I would also say, I think, like, there's ways that even the, you know, I think it was underrated how Mikey Sherrill was talking about, you know, using declaring state of emergency for electricity prices. I'm like, there's a way that you do a direct to voter type of politics, and you don't have to be a leftist for that. Like, and so I think that that's a big lesson to me if I was a Democrat from the last several years. And I think that's kind of an abundancy theme is like ditch, like, you know, lose the bureaucracy of it all a little bit and, you know, do a type of politics that has a tangible impact.
Yeah. And to your point, all we learned about Mikey Sherrill, at least the shorthand of her, was she's a moderate, right?
Right, right, right. And so I'm saying moderates have changed.
Again, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm like, is that, if you would say in abstract, candidate says they want to declare a state of emergency.
Yes.
And to would that be moderate? You know, like, I think 10 years ago, we would have called that, you know, state control, you know, progressive strong army government, right?
That's right. In the same way, Donald Trump saying, you give me 10% of your company, right?
For sure.
Intel, yeah, great. We got a deal. The government owns 10%. That's...
Even the No Kings rally.
Yes.
I'm like, are those, that's supposed to be what the moderate, I mean, or center left version of the Democratic Party. I'm like, there is an activation that is beyond ideology for that group. They want changes in how Democrats perform politics too. And so I think that is a little bit of a thing that I keep trying to express to people. And honestly, a thing that I took away from the last 4 years, the process matters. Like the explaining to people, the process matters. Like the amount of times I talked about the DNC winter meeting is insane.
Dude, I was just going back through that run-up era. And I remember listening to that episode where you asked she was the chair of the DNC, right?
Yeah.
Or of the rules committee. Well, basically what you're doing is you're kind of rigging it for Biden. And she's like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, as a hardened political observer, I was like, well, of course.
Yeah.
That's how parties work.
That's how parties work.
Instead,
you
are the silly one that you didn't get the joke. Parties exist to do this.
Yes.
Right? What we assume is that, well, the voters also know that.
Yes.
Right?
They don't.
And that they're okay with it.
And that they're okay with it. And they weren't. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a huge lesson of mine was like, it does require a kind of moment where you have to be willing, like you have to be willing to step back and say, wait, you know, have we asked them? Have we asked around? And so one of the things that was super clear about it to me, and part of the reason, you know, I think age became a focus in Biden is just because it was the most flagrant example of a thing that happens all the time. And so, you know, one of the things I remember even in that episode is that sense of like, oh, you don't get it because this is how it's done. And I'm like, no, I do get it. And I know this is how it's done. And I actually think no one's actually asked if that's what they want. And so, you know, but I think it is easier. I don't feel alone in that because I knew I had done the work. I was confident that other people, of all the people we had talked to who were equally confused, you know? And so one of the things I always tell people is I will never forget being at a friend's house in Christmas 2022. And they're like, these are people disconnected from politics. And they're like, you know, I'm sure in your life too, you're like local politics person to everybody. And they just ask you who's going to win and who's going to run. And like, so they cannot follow the news for the next 6 months. So I was in my normal role and they're like, so who's running for president? And I was like, it's Joe Biden and Donald Trump. And the room was record scratch. Yep. They were like, no way. And I was like, 100%.
Right. They're like, and that's when you start to think, am I missing something? Because it's so obvious. It's right in front of
us. Yeah, no. And I was like, and in my day-to-day Times life, and in my day-to-day CNN life, in my politics world, that was everyone knew. Everyone knows that. Everyone like has just talking about that. And the record scratch was jarring to me because it made me think, oh, you've gotten actually sucked into the assumption of it all. Like, this is crazy. That is actually crazy. Yep. and so I always tell people, it's having those touchstones that informed the journey because I knew there was a disconnect. And so no one was going to like tweet me out of knowing that, you know? Like, and so now I'm thinking differently because I think that page is turned. And so I think now we need to make something that reaches people in the now, that actually has an ideas marketplace for an open primary on DNR where the questions are massive. I just feel like the 2019 conversation Democrats had about who they wanted to be was closed off because of electability. And Joe Biden really just won that you didn't have to think about that. And we should just prioritize beating Donald Trump. That conversation will be starting from the ground up come those years. And Republicans have avoided that same question through Trump and his force of personality too. And so I just feel like come 27, I think come 26 is going to be, I think, a year of like tension and chaos. I feel like I feel America 250th. I think this administration has shown itself to be unwilling to calibrate to public opinion.
Yeah.
I think they would. I don't think they're moving out of concern of midterms backlash. And so it feels to me that those tension points are really going to come to a head. And so I want to be in a place come 2027 where you can live in the marketplace of ideas.
A quick break, and we'll be back with Estead Herndon. If you want to stay up to date on redistricting news, and I know you do, check out our new interactive redistricting map. It highlights the latest developments in redistricting efforts across the country, and best of all, it's free. That's right. Free. It's in front of the paywall. Go to cookpolitical.com/redistricting to check it out. So let's get at that for a minute because there are already like 463 Democrats lining themselves up. And on the Republican side, everybody goes, oh, well, it's going to be JD, maybe Marco.
Yeah.
So if you said in a room, that same room, when they said, well, who's going to be the Republican nominee? Like, it's going to be JD. Would people go, really?
No. I think he probably has more vulnerabilities than we know in terms of, like it's not clear to me. This is the question I have with JD Vance. He is not a one-to-one to Donald Trump's ideology, nor is he a one-to-one with MAGA movement. But he definitely has consolidated a portion of Republican base who expects him to be that successor. So I just don't know where that lands. And so I don't know which version of himself he would present as Republican Party leader. That to me is an interesting question. Like, which version do we get?
Yeah. And we're already starting to see, and I'm curious if how you would see this or say this, but you know, in some ways the Donald Trump grip, ironclad grip on the party feels like it is loosening just a tiniest bit. Mm-hmm. You've got the Epstein files getting released, right? You've got these Indiana legislators, even as they're being swatted and pressured by the White House, say, we're not going to read district. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to make of Marjorie Taylor Greene and this sudden conversion, but she is speaking in a way and speaking at his real vulnerabilities and the real vulnerabilities for the party going into 2026, especially on healthcare.
I would, I mean, if I was J.D. Vance, Marjorie Taylor Greene is your number one opponent.
Well, that's a great point.
In the last 4 or 5 months, I think Marjorie Taylor Greene is a legitimate 2028er.
Help us square the circle. Republican Congress doesn't push back on Trump taking away their power of the purse.
Yeah.
Doesn't
yeah.
push away on some of the things he's doing that, again, take away their congressional authority.
Yeah.
We've got the military bombing boats in the Caribbean. And yet, the one issue where Republicans really unite to push back against Donald Trump is on these files or whatever, the evidence from a disgraced sex trafficker. Like, how does that work? What does that tell us about where our politics is now?
I mean, I think Trump's relationship with GOP right now is really, really interesting. But I think he's done himself a lot of harm. The biggest being tariffs, in my opinion. I think that introduced the idea of him not following through on a premise of campaign. I think kind of like Biden, it prioritizes your own ideological project over voter response. So I think tariffs is number one, most important thing he's done. Two is Epstein. Like, I don't think we can underrate how few issues caused Donald Trump to look legitimately inauthentic, you know? And in this issue, he is protecting his powerful friends, you know? And he can't get around it. And, you know, I think people really sometimes underappreciate the kind of mini movements that make up MAGA, you know? But it definitely has a lane. I remember being with these people like 2017-ish, the like Ron Paul-y anti-government lane of Arizona guy, you know? And all I'm saying is that's the type of thing that actually they will not budge on. You know, and so Republicans were moved to push Trump because their base moved them.
Well, yeah, demanded it of them.
Demanded them. And there are so few things in our gerrymandered era that actually cut through like that.
Yeah.
And so I think I think Epstein was some, I think that was an issue where it's being driven by TikTok social media. And I think it actually causes him to do something he rarely looks small, I think. Like, he rarely looks afraid. And I think he is moved like someone who is on this. And that has actually, I think, been damaging to the second term brand. So, you know, I'm someone who thinks that, like, Congress's abdication of power is a huge story of this year. That the agenda through executive authority is... the Stephen Millering of the presidency is a huge thing. And I say that because I feel like a thing that we have to explain to people is actually insulates him from politics as usual. So he doesn't have to think about midterm backlash in the same way if the agenda is executed through the presidency, obviously.
Right.
So that's what I'm telling folks right now is like, yeah, I can tell you all the ways that Democrats are up in the congressional ballot. I can, you know, I can tell you the ways I think they might do themselves some favors in terms of stuff, you know. But I don't know if this White House, I don't know if it does what we think it usually does with this White House. And I think holding both of those things is now our responsibility to tell people. We know they're in an effort to circumvent and consolidate power. And so that matters just as much as the ballot box.
As what actually occurs from the election, which I think voters are more clear about now than ever, right?
Yes.
When I used to have to explain why it would matter for the president to lose control, his party to lose control of one body or the other, I'd say, well, you know, now fewer things get done in Congress, and now he's going to have to use his executive authority, right? It was Barack Obama, I've got a pen and a phone, right? That, so that was just, well, he's already, to your point, he's already doing that. And it's so he was, Congress was really, even when he had, even with Republican control, was not there as a vehicle to push expansive legislation in the way that traditional politicians have done. But that also brings me to the question, instead of like, what are Democrats taking away from this? Right. In some ways, they say, well, we need to be like Donald Trump. We need to be more authentic. We need to show voters that we can be heterodox in our ideology. We have to get out of being so prescriptive on some of our opinions on, you know, the sort of identity politics. But how do they do that and also stay true to what the Democratic Party is and what its voters want?
I think Ro Khanna has shown that, like, well, I think there's a couple things you can take away from even how they have played it. Like, one, you know, I do think that engaging with Republicans can produce some results on the right issue. And so I think Khanna has been successful in terms of driving this wedge with the help of Massey. And I think that example on a particular issue where it feels like, you know, the us versus them, kind of insiders, outsiders, I do think people want a party that is advocating against what feels like the rich and powerful, the abuser, whatever, whatever. I also think that, like, the class-forward language is beneficial for center-left and progressive-left. That, to me, is a takeaway from this last round, is so much of the movement that I think Democrats were envisioning were going to make them successful was a multiracial coalition, right? And I think they have learned the difficulties of identity-first coalition. That, to me, was flattening what was a really tough task. But, you know, the Bernie Sanders coalition is, or a coalition of renters, as Zoran talks about, you know, I think is somewhat, to me, where the future is going. Beyond, because the kind of traditional politics has died. You know, what was clear in our reporting with Cuomo, he was still relying on those endorsers. He was still relying on unions. He's still relying on these kind of traditional machines that were supposed to do the same thing. And right now, the machine that's worth the most is probably TikTok. The machine that I would want the capital for is YouTube. And so I think Democrats are coming to see that. But they've had some successes. I mean, I think No Kings has been successful, even in highlighting this time of executive authority. I think the shutdown fight highlighted the rise in healthcare premiums. I think they have a leadership problem. And I think, like, they somewhat have leaders that are disconnected from the rising tide of the last several years. But I don't think the signs for them are all horrible. And the person who's given them the most trouble electorally is Donald Trump.
Right.
And he does reach someone who Republicans have not found a way to replicate otherwise. Yeah. And so I don't think it's all negative for them. I do think they have a problem of an affirmative vision. Like, as we've talked to so many voters, they have filled in their own blanks for what they believe Democrats are prioritizing because they do not feel like they're getting a consistent message. That's their 2027 task.
And who's doing a decent job of that right now? Is there anyone?
Yeah, I mean, I've been living in too much New York mayor stuff, like, so I don't really know if I know. But I would say that I think that, to me, is where the midterms, early races will give us some early through lines. You know, I said this on another show, but I'm like, if I were Democrats, I would sit in the woods for 3 months. and once I got out, I would say, here are the things I never budge on. And we all agree that we believe this, you know? And so if you leave that woods and you don't think defending trans people should be there, then stop wishy-washy. Then actually you should say, in the kind of way that people have 180'd on, defund. And I think people are willing to hear them in some ways. I think you can pivot if you want to pivot. I think actually a hard pivot is much more well-received than a faux triangulation. And so if I'm them, go defend people and stand by people or don't. And so that, to me, is where they get into their authenticity problem. It's like, I actually don't even think it's necessarily about what they are deciding, more so than it doesn't really, I'm not even sure if they believe what they decided. And I think that has to change.
Yeah, and that's the question about this conversation on being class forward instead, because in some ways you could argue that, sure, Donald Trump does present in a way that is class forward.
Sometimes,
who he's looking out for sometimes. And at the same time, this tax bill is,
for sure,
right? Who's benefiting the most? Now, he's doing a not very, he personally has not done as good of a job as he could in selling this as, look, no tax on tips. No, right? That's what we thought he was going to be spending much of his time doing, and he's not. But the point is, that is not the most class-forward tax bill you could have.
Yes. Yeah, it has been, and I think it's actually part of what has hurt him. It's been the mismatch from expectation to reality, and I think the prioritizing of traditional Republican interests.
There we go.
And you can't say you're working-class, people of color focused, and SNAP benefits are getting are on the chopping block, and you don't care, right? I think there actually has. I'm like, he changed in a voting base, but he did not change a policy priority. And I think that is actually is a driver of some of the shifts we've seen this year. And so I don't think it's been meaningless that he hasn't followed through. I just think it's hard for them. It's hard for me when I talk about them, though, because I'm like, he hasn't followed through, nor do I think they care that they haven't. You know, like, they're still full speed ahead.
Well, that goes to the point of the 2024 electorate and the strategy that the Trump campaign put together to build an electorate to elect Donald Trump was based really on how can we do it in this moment, not how can we build this into an enduring coalition based on a shared set of values, right? And that's why when people talk about, are we in a realigning moment? You say, well, it's realigning only if, as you said, those promises made or those expectations put forward, get met.
Right. If Donald Trump was a movement leader who, you know, was kind of like, you know, Mamdani level follow through on campaign promises and felt like he had some need to shift the priorities of the GOP to actually match its working class influx of voters, we would be talking about a different thing. I think that a realignment in the context of the election and among those candidates. And I think Trump has really succeeded on being an expert diagnoser of problems. He recognizes where places of society are not working, and he names them in ways that a lot of establishment will not. So I think that means something. I mean, I was telling people, like, you know, even when we talk about abundance and kind of improving people's conditions and cities and lives, I'm like, Donald Trump was going to those communities and saying, what do you have to lose because Democrats are failing you? And people mock that message, and that is a real one. That's the thing I hear all the time. And so I'm like, Trump, diagnosis. And so I think you can win an election, particularly as a challenger, with that skill. But when you're in the office and it's actually about what he's doing, then I think it all kind of collapses because we care a lot less about his diagnosing of problems now. It's time to do something. And the set of solutions he has, in my opinion, like, this is, we're getting the Stephen Miller presidency. And I think if you would ask those same people, they wouldn't have signed up for that. But that's how politics works, you know? Like, I'm like, do they have to follow through? Yeah.
That is still consistent. All right, ending this with a fun one. Estead, you're a big soccer fan.
Yes.
We have the World Cup
coming
up. It will be here, which will be huge. It is also corresponding with the 250th, as you pointed out. What is this going to look like? I can assume Donald Trump is going to want to make both of those things.
Oh, my goodness. I think it's an underrated collision course. I think that we have seen them kind of up the ante in terms of planning this kind of patriotism, America 250th thing for next year. And I think just I think people should really understand the scope of what the World Cup is going to mean. Those early rounds are U.S., Canada, and Mexico, but it comes for the later rounds only across the country. And so this will control 2 months of most American cities and most of American culture and global culture, really. And the influx of people, the questions about immigration, the I just think are huge things. And so you saw even Mamdani kind of centered this in, you know, he's a big soccer fan, but he's also talking about it is a moment for New York and it is a moment for public policy. And so there's been little things already, like FIFA has deferred to Donald Trump to say he can move matches from cities if he wants. Now, everyone thinks that would be a disaster. And we know that Donald Trump will probably wield that against blue cities he doesn't like. But FIFA, who holds its offices in Trump Tower, is playing this ingratiation game in hopes that they can make it through the tournament. And so you saw them. They've been frequent visitors of the White House at the MBS dinner. You saw Cristiano Ronaldo there yesterday. This has been a big courting effort for the last several years, and it is culminating next summer. But the thing is, like, I mean, their plan, it seems, is to hope and pray that the opportunity and spectacle is such that he doesn't disrupt. And I just feel like that's a bad Donald Trump bet.
Well, it's also going to be interesting, as said, because, sorry, USA men, they're not very good. They're not going to get anywhere in this tournament. So this isn't going to be...
This isn't about us, really.
You know, U.S. versus the world. This is really the world coming to the U.S.
It's the world coming to the U.S. at a time when Trump is going to try to do a nationalism bazaar. You know, nationalism, a countrywide nationalism fest. And so I'm saying just tonally, those two things are going to be in huge collision. And then logistically, this is a huge influx of people into majority to a lot of our big cities. And so I'm thinking, I mean, New York already, I know the businesses downtown are already organizing, planning. And so I think partly because of American distance to soccer, I think partly because of politics, political reporting's distance to like culture and things, hasn't fully set in. You know, huge protests I imagine will be happening too. Like, what's going to happen when certain countries show up? And you know, I can't imagine Russia, I can't imagine Israel, I can't imagine those games are going to go without incident or note. You know, those have been things that have been playing out across the world in international matches
That's
already.
That's right. Well, and in cycling, the...
Right, and in cycling, we just had that too. So I'm like, these are things that I think just, you know, even in terms of my timing, in terms of next year, I'm like, in my head, I was like, take this year, start thinking about the buckets, like, start preparing yourself because it is going to be a mess.
And who is your who's the favorite in Ested's mind?
For the tournament?
For the World Cup, yeah.
I would say Argentina or France. Argentina's been playing really, they won the last World Cup. They have barely even lost since then. And I think Messi's going to do his one last job.
I thought that was his last time.
We thought so, but he's really acting like he's going to play. And he's unfortunately still quite good. And so I think he's going to do it under the hopes of, like, you know, the itch. And the team is successful with and without him. Right. And so I think they're kind of my early, I know repeating's hard, but I would bet on Argentina.
See, look how much you can learn, everybody, from talking to Ested. We covered the gamut. New York mayor's race, national politics, international soccer. We can do all of it. Thanks so much and good luck in getting your buckets together. And we can start listening to you when? When can we start hearing you officially?
Next spring. So next spring we'll launch a show, but I'll be on Today Explain, hosting and making stuff for Fox till then.
Okay. Well, that's perfect. So now we know how to find you. Thanks, Ested.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.